they started noticing questionable and irregular activity related to absentee ballots going all the way back to the month of July.
State elections officials are calling in investigators over ballots in a still undecided Anchorage Republican primary. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, August 27th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, grants for low-income Alaska college students are in short supply.
Need-based aid continues to shrink as a share of the total state aid as compared to merit aid, which we see is on the rise.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Lead is bad for the health of Alaskans, especially for young children. It affects developing brains, so even small amounts are unsafe. Lead can be hiding in older paint, workplaces, ammunition, fishing weights, aviation gas, and marine paint. If you think you or your child has been exposed, ask a healthcare provider about testing. Get the lead out, Alaska. Learn more at leadfree.dhss.alaska.gov. This message brought to you by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Alaska elections officials have asked criminal investigators to look into irregularities with absentee ballots requested in a neck-and-neck state house race in East Anchorage. Seven applications for ballots in the district were in the names of dead people. Another two absentee ballots were returned in the names of people who later said they hadn't voted at all. That's, quote, palpable evidence of voter fraud, says a state lawyer. Alaska Public Media's Nat Herz has been following this and joins me on the phone. Nat, what is going on in District 15?
Yeah, well, this is a really tight House race, closely watched. There's a moderate Republican, Gabrielle Ledoux, who had joined in with a mostly Democratic coalition to control the House for the past couple of years, and so Republicans have really been trying to unelect her. And there was a guy that ran against her, Aaron Weaver, in the Republican primary, and he barely campaigned. But the election is now separated by like three votes, and there are several hundred absentee and other ballots that still need to be counted. And so that was set to happen tomorrow. And then we get this press release that says they've identified all these irregularities with the absentee ballots in this district. And, you know, really kind of shocking stuff, as you just mentioned. And after waiting for about half an hour, one of the candidates, Ledoux, comes out with her attorney, doesn't want to say anything. I wait for a little while longer, and a state attorney comes out of the meeting room and brings me back into a meeting room with the director of the elections division, Josie Banky, a couple other folks from the elections division, and there are two state lawyers there ready to talk about this. They didn't want me to record them, but basically they kind of walk me through the sequence of what happened here. And basically they started noticing some sort of questionable and irregular kind of activity related to absentee ballots going all the way back to the month of July. And they actually made this referral, it sounds like, to the Department of Law's criminal division before the election. There were 70 absentee ballot requests that were, the ballots were mailed out and then came back as undeliverable. And of the 70 undeliverable ballots all across the state, 40 of them were from this one House district. And to put that into context, there were 40 House districts where, you know, there are elections happening, and 10 Senate districts, and yet this one House district has 40 returned absentee ballots. And then you've got these other issues that they subsequently identify with dead people requesting ballots, and then two people that they found who, you know, someone had requested absentee ballots in their names and they'd been returned, but then the people whose absentee ballots were returned in their names, they said they hadn't voted.
So I imagine they'll be looking at if there's any sort of broader implications here, but have they said at this point anything about who they think might be responsible for these irregularities?
No, they haven't linked, you know, no one official has linked these irregularities to either of the campaigns or to any other individual or group. One thing that folks in the political world are looking at is the Republicans sort of leading into the absentee ballot review. Noticed that there were a couple of addresses in like a Muldoon trailer park where there were 23 people, all with the same last name, who had requested absentee ballots from two different addresses in this trailer park. So again, 23 people requesting absentee ballots from two different addresses in a trailer park. And one of the names of the absentee ballot requests was a man who was paid by Ledoux's campaign and who has, you know, a long relationship with Ledoux dating back several years to doing outreach in various ethnic communities in her district. That's how she describes what she pays him for in her campaign disclosure filings. And so that was something that Republicans, who again are, you know, really gunning for Ledoux and trying to get rid of her, they're saying that, you know, they were raising some questions about that and saying they, you know, just wanted to be sure that if these ballots came back, you know, they were being really scrutinized carefully. And again, you know, this was something I was hoping to talk to Representative Ledoux about today. And again, she was there with an attorney, Tom Amodio, but they both declined to comment when I tried to ask them questions this afternoon.
Well, we will continue to follow that. That's Alaska Public Media's Nat Herz. Thanks, Nat.
Thanks for having me.
Fall semester classes have started at University of Alaska campuses, and here's an interesting statistic. The state has the lowest percentage of students from low-income families attending university in the country. There is a state-run grant program designed to help more low-income Alaskans afford college, but as Alaska Public Media's Aaron McKinstry reports, it receives half as much money as the state's merit-based program.
Nairak Kwani studies accounting at the University of Alaska Anchorage. She and her two sisters are the first in their family to attend college. Kwani gets around $4,000 every year from two state programs, the Merit-Based Alaska Performance Scholarship and the Needs-Based Alaska Education Grant. She says she probably wouldn't be at college without them.
And I just thought, here's what you have available. You can really, you know, benefit and profit off this, you know, reward that you were given. Why not take it?
Kwani's mother immigrated from Sudan before she was born. She's a widow and a single mom of eight. The federal financial aid application calculates that Kwani's family can't afford to pay anything to send her to college. But thanks to federal and state aid and a job at Olive Garden, she's currently debt-free.
With those, I've actually haven't paid any money out of pocket other than my parking pass.
But there are a lot of students in Kwani's shoes who aren't so lucky. Well over 1,000 qualified low-income students don't receive Alaska Education Grant funding each year. That's because funding for the program dries up before all the need can be met. In contrast, the Merit-Based Alaska Performance Scholarship funds everyone who qualifies. The Alaska Education Grant receives half as much funding as the Alaska Performance Scholarship, as outlined by state law. To qualify for that scholarship, students have to take certain classes in high school, maintain a certain GPA, and score well on standardized tests. So why prioritize one over the other? University of Alaska's Saichi Oba says his sense is that the system is set up to value merit. He's the assistant vice president of student and enrollment services.
And I just don't think maybe there's enough understanding of what the real need is for low-income families who would like to send their child to college, or a mother and father who would like to attend college themselves, perhaps to finish a degree.
The performance scholarship is also meant to keep college-educated students in state and contributing to the economy. Alaska isn't alone in prioritizing merit-based aid. The Institute for Higher Education Policy's president, Michelle Cooper, says it's a trend they're seeing across the country.
Need-based aid continues to shrink as a share of the total state aid as compared to merit aid, which we see is on the rise.
She says merit-based programs tend to be politically popular. They often give middle and high-income students more choices when looking at colleges. Needs-based programs, in contrast, often determine whether low-income students attend college at all.
So it really promotes access. It helps students get into the door.
Alaska's programs in their current state were a product of the Parnell administration. The legislature has tried to cut funding or even eliminate both programs, mostly because of the state's budget crisis. Stephanie Butler is the executive director of the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, the organization that runs both programs. She thinks there's less funding for the needs-based program, in part because it was tacked onto a bill at the last minute and because money for education is tight. She says, in general, the legislature sees the benefits of both programs.
Especially when we get a low-income student, out of a dependency status where they're dependent on the state for income and into the workforce where they can earn a living wage. And that's really transformative for generations. And it's also transformative for the Alaska economy.
Butler says they'd love to be able to fund all low-income students. But for now, the commission prioritizes who they fund based on factors like financial need and whether the students received the award in the past. And that means students like Kwani are left wondering whether they'll have to foot the bill for an extra couple $1,000s every year. Kwani says right now she plans to graduate in 4 years, but a cut to her funding could change that.
I have taken 5 classes a semester. That is very pricey on my end. And so if I didn't have that, I'd probably have to minimize the amount of classes I have. So I think that's how it would hurt me. I'd have to end up being in school longer.
If everything goes according to plan, she'll be working as an accountant by 2020. And she's hoping that'll inspire her younger siblings to go to college too, and maybe even pursue graduate school. In Anchorage, I'm Erin McKinstry.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Alaska fishermen are worried over the ongoing tariff battles with China.
This could be a short-term deal, and you don't want to move away from a market that has a lot of value and a lot of potential.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. And by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at Matson.com.
Anchorage attorney Jonathan Katchen has withdrawn his name from consideration for a seat on the U.S. District Court bench. Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin reports.
President Trump nominated Katchen to the court in April, but the Senate Judiciary Committee never scheduled a confirmation hearing. Katchen says the process and the timing were uncertain, and he says he decided to end the waiting and focus his attention on his legal practice. He's an attorney at Holland & Hart. Katchen is in his early 40s and was a law clerk for Judge Marianne Trump Barry, the president's sister. His nomination had enthusiastic support from U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan. Sullivan was Katchen's boss at the Alaska Departments of Law and Natural Resources. Alaska's two U.S. senators jointly submitted a list of 5 candidates for the president to consider, but Senator Lisa Murkowski did not issue a statement supporting Katchen. In a poll of Alaska Bar Association members, only 31% of respondents rated Katchen well or extremely well qualified for the federal bench. It was unclear how many just didn't know the name. Katchen has focused on regulatory and natural resource law. He has little courtroom experience and has never practiced criminal law. For Alaska Public Media, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Weather kept Governor Bill Walker from attending a signing ceremony for a pharmacy bill in Petersburg this morning. Walker was expected to fly to Petersburg for the signing of House Bill 240. It's a bill that creates tighter regulation on pharmacy benefit managers, or PBMs. Those are companies hired by health insurance providers to negotiate drug prices with the companies that make the medications and the businesses that sell them. Small businesses say the PBM companies frequently reimburse them below cost for medication, forcing them to take a loss. The bill creates a more transparent appeal process for pharmacies disputing the reimbursement amount, and it gives the state's Division of Insurance the final say in those disagreements. It also ends prohibitions on pharmacies telling customers about a cheaper out-of-pocket option for medication and a mailing restriction to rural parts of Alaska. The bill was sponsored by Fairbanks Democrat David Guttenberg and had legislators signing on as sponsors from both sides of the aisle. Guttenberg was able to attend the signing ceremony after arriving in Petersburg Sunday. He praised the work done by the pharmacists to get the bill passed.
You know, being articulate, focusing about local pharmacies, how important they are in our local towns when there's not a big pharmacy or chain store, and the loss of them and the way they are billed or not billed, and some of it doesn't make sense, but from the PBM's perspective it does, but not for the people on the ground.
The bill passed the House and Senate without any legislative opposition in the spring. It was opposed by pharmacy benefit management companies, insurance providers, and their trade associations. Insurers say the pharmacy benefit managers help prevent fraud and keep the cost of medication down. They argued against giving the state the authority to decide reimbursement amounts. The bill had support from Alaska's Board of Pharmacy and by the National Community Pharmacists Association. Both noted that 34 other states have passed some kind of stricter regulation on these companies. Governor Walker's office says he still plans on signing the bill at a later date. A former Nome Community Service officer who pleaded guilty in July to charges of assault while on duty is working again at the Nome Police Department. Carl Putman has been hired as an emergency hire temporary dispatcher. Putman admitted during investigations that when an intoxicated woman passed out, he became frustrated and punched her in the head with a balled fist. In July, Putman pleaded guilty and received a one-year suspended imposition of sentence. According to City Manager Tom Moran, Putman was rehired as an emergency hire, meaning that the job is not required to be posted to the public and that the position only lasts for up to 6 months. At any point, the role could be filled by a qualified candidate. While Moran was aware of what he called Putman's, quote, criminal allegations, he explained that there are no criminal barriers from working dispatch. There have been previous dispatchers with criminal convictions. He said, quote, we do not have the resources, do not have the people available to us, the applicant pool on file may not be the best applicant the public would feel to be the best candidate. But there are Nome citizens who feel that this furthers the distrust between the police department and community members, including Florence Habros, the victim of the assault back in February. Habros says she was not notified by the NPD that Putman would be hired as a dispatcher, and she said she would not feel comfortable calling dispatch knowing he could pick up. When asked if she would call the NPD to report a crime, Habros said,
he answers like, dispatcher, it's uncomfortable. I would call the troopers, yeah, state troopers, I would call them instead. They would help me out.
Putman's new role does not include any patrol duties or physical contact with the public. A 33-year-old Alaska man in state custody on a felony assault charge has died. The Department of Corrections says Kendall Barrett died 2 weeks ago of injuries suffered in a suicide attempt. Barrett was booked on the first-degree assault charge August 11th. 2 days later, a corrections officer found him unresponsive in his cell. Officers and medical staff attempted life-saving measures, and Barrett was transported to a hospital. He died August 14th. The death will be reviewed by the Alaska State Troopers and the State Medical Examiner. The Corrections Department of Professional Conduct Unit will conduct an internal investigation. The department reported the death on Monday.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
The U.S. and China have levied tariffs on billions of dollars of goods in both countries amid an escalating trade dispute. And caught in the crosshairs is the Alaska fishing industry. But as KBBI's Aaron Bolton reports, it's not the Chinese tariffs that are giving the industry heartburn. It's a proposed tariff on seafood imported from China.
The Alaska seafood industry has a unique relationship with China. Nearly $1 billion worth of seafood was exported into the country in 2017. But that's just the first step in a global supply chain.
So much of our exports to China are reprocessed and re-exported.
Garrett Everidge is a fisheries economist with the McDowell Group. And he says after those fish are reprocessed, they're exported into markets around the world, including the U.S. And China kept that in mind when it levied a 25% tariff on U.S. seafood earlier this summer.
The majority of those exports are going to be excluded from those tariffs.
The Trump administration is currently considering a list of retaliatory tariffs on $200 billion worth of Chinese goods. On that list is a 25% levy on seafood imported from China, including products from Alaska reprocessed in the country.
As of right now, there's no indication that product originating in Alaska would be excluded from those import tariffs. It's kind of an unusual situation where the U.S. would be, in effect, taxing production from a U.S. state.
Jeremy Woodrow with the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute explains just the possibility of that tariff is already causing Chinese fish buyers to hold off on purchasing seafood from Alaska, which may create a backlog of frozen product in the U.S.
So I'm really not sure the volume of backlog, but I just do know that there is some uncertainty in the market, and there's some hesitancy to pull the trigger on those purchases by our traditional buyers that we have already set in place.
Woodrow explains that processing any backlog domestically would be costly both in terms of labor and in the volume the state exports.
It's easy to assume that we would keep that product here in the U.S., but the unfortunate part is that there might not be the capacity to process that product in the United States.
However, demand for Alaska seafood is high, and other countries may fill the void left by Chinese buyers. At least one major processor who didn't wish to speak publicly confirmed other foreign buyers are picking up some of that slack. That's good news, but the processor also says this year's pink salmon harvest came in under forecast, and that it may be harder to sell larger volumes of fish if the dispute lasts. Woodrow also warns that selling fish to non-traditional buyers could put a strain on Alaska's relationship with the Chinese market.
This could be a short-term deal, and you don't want to move away from a market that has a lot of value and a lot of potential.
If it's not a short-term deal, that frozen backlog could grow large and prices on the docks could fall. Morgan Jones is a commercial seiner based in Homer. Inside his boat, Jones says despite the trade dispute, prices have been good this year.
The processors are still interested in buying all the fish we can get. And, you know, from the initial price from last year is up a little bit. We certainly haven't seen a negative impact yet.
But ex-vessel prices are typically based on the previous year, and any impact on the docks is likely to be seen in 2019. Jones has seen this happen before. He recalls prices for pink salmon being cut in half after the U.S. sanctioned Russia following its annexation of Crimea in 2014.
So that was a huge deal for us. So we always pay attention and kind of watch these things with concern.
The U.S. Trade Representative's office is taking public comment on the proposed list of tariffs. Many in the industry want Chinese seafood dropped from the list or an exemption for products originating in the U.S. A spokesperson with the office said in an email Friday that there's no set timeline for the list to be finalized after the comment period ends on September 6, but previous rounds of tariffs have been finalized and implemented within just weeks of the comment period ending, which could have Alaska's fishing industry bracing for more uncertainty. Reporting in Homer, I'm Aaron Bolton.
One of Southwest Alaska's largest airlines will soon be up for sale. A federal judge has ordered Pennair to be auctioned off this October, more than a year after the company filed for bankruptcy protection. The carrier is promising residents of the Aleutian and Pribilof Islands that their only connection to Anchorage won't just vanish. But as KUCB's Laura Craigle reports, some change is likely coming.
The Siebert family founded Alaska-grown Pennair in 1955, and they still own it today. The company includes 430 employees, 10 airplanes, and 8 routes across Bristol Bay, the Alaska Peninsula, and the Aleutian chain. Last August, the airline filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy with $15 million worth of debt. It's incurred another $5 million since then to stay operating. But CEO Danny Siebert doesn't seem too concerned. He's issued this message to customers with help from spokesperson Missy Roberts.
They should know that I'm going to still be here.
We're not leaving.
No, I'm not leaving. I've been flying in Southwest Alaska for 45 years. I got another 45 years left in me.
That promise comes after a bankruptcy court judge scheduled an auction this fall when the company will be sold to the most competitive bidder. Siebert says flights will continue normally during what's called a 363 sale,
which is the sale of the company's assets as an entire operating entity.
That means the top bidder will take control of everything Pennair owns, leases, or won by contract, minus its debts.
All the employees, all the aircraft, all the routes, the entire business that we're doing today will still be the same business that operates the day after the sale.
At least it'll still be that same business until a new owner decides to change things. That's according to Jerry McHale, an accountant from Florida who's been court-appointed to oversee the sale as an independent trustee.
My role is to attempt to stabilize the situation. I don't want somebody to buy the company on Friday and shut down the routes on Monday.
After the sale is complete, McHale says Penair's new owner will be free to add or delete routes as they see fit. But any bidder who wants to be truly competitive will have to submit a plan for continued air service in the region. McHale says he already has plenty of bidders lined up, all of whom fit that description.
Even today, I've had two come out of the woodwork today. I am unaware of anyone wanting to stop routes currently.
That said, Penair, under its current management, flies a few routes that are guaranteed by Essential Air Service, a federal program that subsidizes companies who serve small communities. McHale says he can't be sure a new owner will do the same.
I believe it's McGrath and St. Paul that are currently being operated under what they call an EAS program. Those programs, I understand, are out for bid. I don't know that a new buyer would want to bid on those or not. I just don't know.
While the fates of those routes play out in a separate bidding process managed by the U.S. Department of Transportation, McHale says he's doing everything he can to get a responsible buyer at the head of Penair. Bidders have to submit audited financial statements and letters of credit to prove their upfront ability to buy the airline. They also have to demonstrate how they'll cover ongoing costs for aircraft maintenance, insurance, and storage, on top of convincing the Federal Aviation Administration that they have a credible safety program. With that criteria, McHale says there will only be so many competitive bidders. And as for rumors that the Siebert family hopes to buy out and relaunch their own company, he says there's no reason they can't try.
If Danny and his group want to put in a bid, they're welcome to it, but they're no different than, I'll pick some names out, Alaska Air or Wexford or Raven, anybody.
Already this year, Raven Alaska has expanded to Dillingham and King Salmon, two communities previously connected to Anchorage by Penair alone. In January, the carrier also said it's considering a new route to Unalaska. Meanwhile, Wexford Capital is a company that has issued loans to Penair during the bankruptcy, and Alaska Airlines used to compete with Penair in the Unalaska market before they agreed to partner on the current route. Penair's Danny Siebert declined to comment on the potential competition for his family's business. He also declined to say whether he'll make an offer himself.
I'm not going to tell you yet, but watch your bids carefully.
The auction is slated for the first or second week of October. Both Penair officials and trustee McHale say it will not affect holiday travel or the busy winter fishing season. In Unalaska, I'm Laura Craigle.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Nat Herz, Aaron McKinstry, and Liz Ruskin in Anchorage, Aaron Bolton in Homer, Emily Hofstadter in Nome, Jake Steinberg in Juneau, Joe Vicknicki in Petersburg, and Laura Craigle in Unalaska. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by First National Bank Alaska, offering online and mobile services to help Alaskans and their businesses bank on the go. Learn how experience and knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. Lead is bad for the health of Alaskans, especially for young children. It affects developing brains, so even small amounts are unsafe. Lead can be hiding in older paint, workplaces, ammunition, fishing weights, aviation gas, and marine paint. If you think you or your child has been exposed, ask a healthcare provider about testing. Get the lead out, Alaska. Learn more at leadfree.dhss.alaska.gov. This message brought to you by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. You know your teenager is struggling, friends have changed, grades have dropped, and when you try to talk, they argue or ignore you. Don't wait until it gets worse. Take action by calling Alaska Crossings. Alaska Crossings has helped hundreds of teens gain back their confidence and self-esteem in a full, fun, outdoor environment. The program is now accepting applications for troubled teens ages 12 to 18. Visit alaskacrossings.org and apply today. Alaska Crossings. Youth succeed here. This message sponsored by Alaska Crossings. This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.